Welcome back to the Journal Review. This is JAMA Dermatology, June 2026, and we've got two pieces on the docket today. A clinical pathological challenge case that's a nice diagnostic pearl for anyone doing excisions on simple cysts, and an editorial that tackles a question every one of us who manages high-risk cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma runs into constantly. How do we actually find occult nodal disease before it's clinically obvious? Let's get into it. First up is the clinicopathological challenge, a case report out of Chitose City Hospital and the Sapporo Dermatopathology Institute in Japan. The setup is one you've seen 100 times in clinic. A man in his 70s with a subcutaneous nodule with a central punctum on the thigh, present over 3 years without growth, freely mobile, no history of trauma. Everything about the clinical gestalt screams garden variety epidermoid cyst. He underwent complete excision, which notably was both diagnostic and therapeutic. There was no elaborate workup here, just straightforward surgical management of what looked like a benign cystic lesion. The punchline is where this gets interesting. Histopathology showed an intact dermal keratinizing cyst, continuous with the epidermis, but the cyst wall had a verruciform architecture with perikeratosis, and, this is the key finding, dense papillary dermal infiltrates of foamy histiocytes wrapping around the cyst wall and extending into the papillary projections, confirmed a CD68 positive on immunohistochemistry. The final diagnosis, cystic verruciform xanthoma. This is a rare histologic variant of verruciform xanthoma, a lesion classically described in oral mucosa, gingiva, palate, tongue, in patients in their 50s and 60s. What makes this case worth knowing about is that, to the author's knowledge, only three prior cases of a cystic variant have ever been reported, and all three, like this one, occurred at extramucosal cutaneous sites rather than the oral mucosa, where garden variety verruciform xanthoma typically lives. The pathophysiology is still speculative. The authors frame verruciform xanthoma as a reactive process rather than a true neoplasm, likely triggered by chronic friction or inflammatory injury to the epithelium, causing keratinocyte breakdown and lipid release that gets mopped up by dermal histiocytes, which then accumulate as the foamy cells you see on the slide. Two of the three previously reported cystic cases arose in settings of chronic friction or recurrent inflammation, one inguinal, one on the nipple with a history of recurrent mastitis. This case had no such antecedent history, so the trigger remains unclear. Human papillomavirus has been investigated as a potential driver and essentially ruled out. The real educational value here is in the histologic differential. Anything with a cystic epidermal invagination, conventional epidermoid cyst, dilated pore of Wiener, pilar sheath acanthoma, can superficially resemble this. The distinguishing features are the verruciform architecture with sharply demarcated perikeratin-filled crypts, and an attenuated or absent granular layer, combined with dense xanthomatous change specifically concentrated in the papillary dermis surrounding the cyst, rather than the patchy, disruption-centered foamy infiltrate you'd see in a ruptured epidermoid cyst with a xanthogranulomatous reaction. The authors are explicit that this pattern recognition, pericystic xanthomatous papillae plus perikeratotic crypts, is the clue that prevents misclassification. Practically, there's no management change here beyond what you already did. Complete excision, which was curative, with no recurrence at 6-month follow-up. The takeaway is purely diagnostic. Keep this entity on your radar as a mimicker when you're reviewing pathology on a lesion you sent over as a routine cyst, particularly if the report mentions a verruciform surface or florid papillary dermal xanthomatosis. It won't change what you do surgically, but it will keep you from being caught off guard by an unusual pathology report, and it's a good one to recognize so you can reassure the patient rather than over-investigate for an oral or systemic xanthomatous process. Now let's turn to the editorial, authored by Selin Tokez and Marlies Wacky out of Erasmus MC in Rotterdam. This is an opinion piece contextualizing a companion original research article in the same issue, Ferrandis, Polito, and colleagues' prospective study on diagnostic modalities for nodal staging in high-risk cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma. The editorial doesn't present new data itself, but it's a genuinely useful synthesis of where we stand on nodal imaging, so let's walk through the argument. The clinical problem is one you know well. Cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma incidence is climbing, risk stratification tools are improving, but we still have no criterion standard imaging modality for detecting occult nodal metastases, and early detection matters enormously for outcomes. The study being discussed is, per the editorialists, a methodologically strong one, a multicenter prospective paired diagnostic design across 13 tertiary dermato-oncology departments in Spain over 3 years, where a physical exam, ultrasonography, and CT were all performed on every patient in a blinded fashion and compared head-to-head. The editorialists flagged this paired blinded design as an important strength. It's rare to get all three modalities compared prospectively in the same patients, rather than pieced together across separate retrospective cohorts. Their honest caveat, though, is that the event count was low, only 12 actual nodometastases in the whole cohort, which limits how firmly you can lean on the numbers. With that caveat up front, the findings track with existing literature. Both ultrasonography and CT clearly outperform clinical palpation at baseline. Whether ultrasonography and CT are interchangeable is murkier. Prior systematic reviews suggest CT edges out ultrasonography on sensitivity and specificity, though in expert hands, ultrasonography can perform very well too, with sensitivity in the low 90s and specificity around 80%. The editorialists note the agreement between ultrasonography and CT in this study was strong, and they read that as good news practically. It means centers can choose whichever modality fits their local expertise and resources, ultrasonography being cheaper, more available, radiation-free, and compatible with same-session fine needle aspiration. Without meaningfully sacrificing accuracy, the most clinically important finding, though, is about immunosuppressed patients. Baseline sensitivity for both ultrasonography and CT was essentially perfect in immunocompetent patients, but collapsed to under a fifth in the immunosuppressed group. The editorialists' interpretation, and they're careful to frame this as their own reasoning rather than a settled fact, is that this isn't really an imaging failure. Rather, in immunosuppressed patients, disease seems to progress so fast, from micrometastatic, radiographically invisible disease to clinically obvious nodal disease, that baseline imaging simply catches these patients at the wrong moment. Consistent with that, the vast majority of nodal metastases in the immunosuppressed group became clinically apparent within just 3 months of that baseline imaging. That observation pivots the piece toward its second major theme: timing of surveillance imaging, not just choice of modality. The editorialists cite several other studies to build the case, one showing that over half of all subclinical nodal metastases across a cohort were picked up specifically through surveillance imaging in the 2 years after baseline. Another more recent prospective study, finding about 1 in 5 subclinical metastases detected this way, which changed management in those patients either fully or partially. Another study found that the large majority of clinically detected nodal metastases actually surfaced during follow-up rather than at baseline, and that clinically overt nodes tended to be larger than those caught by ultrasonography, reinforcing that better timed surveillance could shift more detections into the asymptomatic, more manageable phase. Despite this, the editorialists note plainly that no surveillance imaging schedule has yet made it into formal guidelines, and they call for prediction models and large population-based studies to nail down who should be surveilled, how often, and for how long. The final and most sobering thread is outcomes. Using Dutch nationwide registry data, the 5-year disease-specific survival for cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma overall is around 99%, but that drops to about 79% once nodal metastasis is detected, and it's worse still in immunosuppressed patients. That's the stake that justifies all this diagnostic effort. But here's the honest limitation the editorialists underscore clearly. There is currently no direct evidence that imaging-based detection of subclinical nodal disease actually improves survival. The one available study on this was underpowered for a mortality endpoint, though it did show a non-significant trend toward better disease-free survival with imaging versus no imaging. They draw the same conclusion by analogy to sentinel lymph node biopsy, the established benchmark technique for occult nodal disease in melanoma. Positivity rates in high-risk cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma run in the range of about 1 in 8 to 1 in 5 overall, and up to nearly a third in the highest-risk T2B tumors by Brigham staging. But the survival data on sentinel lymph node biopsy itself are mixed. One retrospective cohort showed a meaningfully reduced risk of disease-specific death in immunocompetent high-risk patients, but not in immunosuppressed patients. And other studies have shown only non-significant trends. So even our best surgical benchmark for early nodal detection hasn't conclusively proven a survival benefit in this disease. The editorialists land in a measured place. They believe identifying subclinical nodal disease matters clinically because it enables more limited, targeted interventions rather than extensive dissections, more accurate staging, and better informed decisions in an era of neoadjuvant immunotherapy. But they're explicit that the evidence base proving a survival benefit remains inconclusive and largely exploratory. For practical purposes, here's how I'd frame the takeaway. Nothing here is immediately practice-changing in terms of a new mandated protocol. There's still no criterion standard, no validated surveillance schedule, and no proof that any of this saves lives. But there are two points worth internalizing for how you counsel and triage patients. First, if you're relying on palpation alone to clear the neck or regional nodal basin in a high-risk cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma patient, this reinforces that you're likely missing disease that either ultrasonography or CT would catch, and the choice between those two modalities can reasonably be driven by what's locally available rather than a rigid hierarchy. Second, and more clinically actionable in the immunosuppressed population specifically, a clean baseline scan in one of these patients should not be reassuring for long. Given how fast nodal disease seems to become clinically apparent after a negative baseline study in this group, a tightened, near-term follow-up or repeat imaging interval for immunosuppressed high-risk patients is a reasonable, low-risk adjustment to make now, even while we wait for formal guideline-level surveillance schedules to catch up. That wraps our two articles for this episode: a rare xanthomatous mimicker of the everyday cyst, and a sobering reminder that our nodal staging tools for cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma are better than palpation, but still far from settled science. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next month.